Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown, out on the edge of the prairie. It's been very cold out there, I hate to say it, but it's true, and it's about to get colder. So the governor issued a proclamation the other day, closing schools across Minnesota, thinking about those little kids who are standing out at the end of driveways in the dark on Monday morning in 20 below weather, even colder, because there's a big wind out there. And of course, it was the right thing to do, although we old-timers thought to ourselves, what about us? Where was the governor when we were kids? 20 below, that was nothing. 30 below, 40 below all the time. We saw the temperature go down to 40 below. It stopped at 40 below because that was as far as your outdoor thermometer would go. Actually, it was 50 or 60 below, and nobody ever canceled school for us. But anyway, it was cold back then. You take a pail of boiling water, and you'd throw it out the back door, and by the time it hit the ground, it tinkled like somebody had thrown dimes out there. It had turned to ice. Anyway, it's been cold. Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery was packed with people who heard the weather forecast, and they were going in to stock up on stuff, on butter and animal fats, because cold trumps the diet. You have to put that aside for a while until it gets warmer. Cheese and wieners and bacon, survival food. That's what you need in order to live. We know who the vegans are. There are four or five of them in town, and we know where they live, and we pay visits to them. We make sure that they're okay, and they're not okay. They sort of pass out. They wander off. They get dizzy. They're confused, and we have to rope them in. We have to stuff fish sticks in them. And are they grateful? No, they're not grateful at all. This is the time of year when TV stations in Southern California send camera crews up to Minnesota to get film footage of snow blowing sideways and go around interviewing people and ask them, why do you live here? We are prepared for this. We see these people all the time. They wear enormous parkas, and they have electric heaters in their pants, and they have tans, and so that marks them right there. Why do you live here? They say, well, we know the right answer. We say, because of this, the cold. Cold is a stimulant. The challenge of survival, this is what keeps us going. This is in our DNA. You can't appreciate warmth unless you experience cold, just as you cannot appreciate food unless you have known hunger. And the camera crew is there. They're all bundled up in these heavy parkas, and their hands are trembling. They can't even hold a camera straight. They just take this brief picture of us, and then they dive back into their trucks, and we sort of waddle back into our homes, and we take off our heavy clothes, and we light a fire in the fireplace, and we turn on our sun lamps, and we run a hot bath, and we climb in. We feel like wood. Our faces feel like wood, all dry and cracked, and we submerge ourselves in a tub, and we lie there until we're pink, until we feel human again, and our bones warm up. Everybody's sort of lethargic after the holidays, and people slept late on New Year's Day, except for those of us who have an enormous sense of obligation and responsibility going back to childhood, and we are unable to sleep late. You're looking at one of them right here. I cannot sleep past 6 o'clock in the morning because it was my job when I was a child to go out and start the car on cold winter mornings, and I would go out there early when it was still dark. This car would never start. It was just frozen. It wouldn't even click when you turned the key in the lock. You had to rock it back and forth. I was just a boy, just a 10, 12-year-old boy, rocked it back and forth because it was frozen to the ground. And then with the door open, I would push against the frame and get it rolling down the hill until it had achieved speed, until it was going fairly fast. And then I would leap in behind the wheel, and I would pump the gas a couple of times and throw it into second gear, and it would start, and off I would go. I was just 10, 12 years old, but it was my job. You had to work in your family back then, no more, but then you did. And you had to go. I drove along the train tracks because the express from Chicago came through at about 5:30 in the morning, and I had to pick up lumps of coal in a box to put them in the trunk for heat for my family. I went back. Not true anymore, but back then it was. We had serious winters back then. That's why people had large families, many children. I grew up in a family of 6 children, to have extras, don't you know? I had a sister, Jeannie, who slammed the storm door walking out the door. She's in a snit, and she slammed the door, and it loosened an icicle that was hanging down from the eave, and it just came down, and that splitter, it just came down, and splitter came right through her. And luckily, her snowsuit was too small for her that year, and that held her two halves together. So they got her down to the hospital, and they sewed her up, and she lived, though she was never the same after that. Actually, she was a nicer person after that. Really did her a lot of good. My brother Ralph, who was just a little kid, younger brother, carried off by coyotes, walking through a blizzard, going to try to catch the school bus because the governor wasn't interested in children back then. Went to catch a school bus, grabbed by coyotes. They dragged him for 7 miles, and they didn't eat him because he was wearing this part polyester snowsuit, and the taste of polyester was not pleasant to the coyotes. So they dropped him off, and this farm family rescued him, and he liked them better, and so he grew up with them, and that was that story. Now it's a discipline. You never lose this discipline of getting up early in the morning when you're in a large family. That's how I got into radio, was because I could work the morning shift, and they knew they could trust me to be there and turn the transmitter on at 5 o'clock in the morning. So we have these jobs after Christmas. The fridge is full of all these disgusting delicacies that people brought that we never would want, these pies that we do not eat, mincemeat and so forth, and pecan pie, more than we would ever want. And now we're on strict diets, so we have to do something with this food, because we hate to throw it away, but so we throw it outdoors for the weasels. The weasels eat it, and other ravenous beasts, and the blue jays and so forth. They'll eat anything. No, we're on this strict diet, hoping to become slender and winsome and attractive, but it's not really working so well, as you can see. But there's still time. Then there's all these gifts to be gotten rid of. A gift represents somebody's conception of who you are and what your taste is, and it's sort of astonishing to look at this pair of bunny slippers with headlights in the toes. And what they thought, this tie-dye bath towel, this enormous blue and green silk flower arrangement in the brass pod. It looks like it belongs in a funeral home, but they gave it to us, the red and the green sweater with a Celtic design in the front, this pink knit toilet paper cover. What was this? This battery-powered coin bank where you set the coin in this little slot, and the little golfer guy comes up and smacks it with his putter, and he rolls it into the hole. What were they thinking? What? It was the first Sunday of Christmas, and Pastor Liz was going to give the sermon on the story of the Holy Family's flight into Egypt and Herod killing all of the firstborn children, but she just wasn't in the mood to deal with the slaughter of the infants, the innocents, and so. And besides, she is a firstborn child, and they represent good and true and dutiful young people, assistant parents. So she skipped the gospel text, and she just gave a sermon about gratitude, don't you know, and being thankful for everything, and being thankful especially for your older siblings who who helped you in ways that your own parents could not when your parents had lost patience with you. She's an older child, as I say, a firstborn in her family, so people come to her with all their problems. We're not brought up to complain in Lake Wobegon. We keep it to ourselves. Don't think you're special. You're no special than anybody else. So, you know, other people are going through the same, so we keep it to ourselves. But she is the designated listener in our town, and she gets all people's troubles, people feeling sad and marriages that are going through a tunnel and kids who are having meltdowns and parents who are helpless to deal with it and all of these troublesome things. And Pastor Liz is reassuring and tells you that you're not the only one and that probably this will all just work itself out. And the answer for everybody is just to get a good night's rest. So we do. New Year's Eve was sort of uneventful in Lake Wobegon. There were two or three parties up for a while, and that was about it. The sidetrack tap was full of people drinking until about 9:30. There was a nice crowd down at the Moonlight Bay Supper Club, people having their romantic candlelit dinners. Clarence and Arlene Bunsen were having their candlelit dinner, their surf and turf with the lobster and the filet mignon, and the whole bottle of wine between the two of them. They were laughing and laughing in ways that we aren't used to seeing Lutherans laugh. And then the waitress brought out this enormous platter, this flaming chocolate volcano dessert, sparklers, and flames coming up out of the volcano and molten chocolate flowing. And Clarence was just about to say, "I didn't order that." And Arlene looked at him and burst into tears. And she said, Oh, sweetheart, how did you know my favorite? And so, even though they were too full to eat it, they made themselves do it. It just seemed like a symbol of the good life, the unexpected good life, the gift of grace. "This is so sweet of you," she said. He was waiting for the waitress to come back and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, this was supposed to go over there," but she did not. It was a bank error in their favor. The goodness of life right there in front of them, sparklers coming up. And he turned and he kissed her, and somebody took a picture of it with their cell phone and sent it to them by email, and that's their souvenir of the evening, the two of them in a big kiss and tears running down her cheek and everybody looking, and sparklers, sparks and flames coming up. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average.